Sometimes you might feel trapped between the right and the left. No one listens when you say taxation is theft.
But there's a place where people know harsh government brings tears. So grab some blue and adrenochrome. Let's make the timeline weird. Friends against government. Friends against government.
They're your
best friends.
Read like every detail to try and remember what the hell's going on.
There's like so many people who contact us and I need to follow up with, and I don't have the memory for that shit.
I just half the time when I'm talking to somebody or I'm just, libertarians love to fucking send these emails that are 12 paragraphs.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm,
yes,
and I'm
they
just
do.
Like, fuck yeah. This, man.
Yeah, right. Three
and
sentences.
Then they get on the phone and they just start rambling and rambling and rambling. And it's like, well, tuned out. Sorry, my cat's next to me. Needed belly rubs.
Yeah, I've been just dropping the ball. Like the
you
last
have? Month. Yeah, what's been going on, Carr? I was gonna
dude,
ask you about that.
Life's in turmoil.
Is it really?
It's for the better. Life's in turmoil.
You're in your 30s. It can't
be. Dude, it is. It is.
What did you say last night? Okay, I saw a text message stream of you and Rollo, and you were profusely apologizing to Rollo for missing his episode, and you texted, "This is unacceptable for a 31-year-old.
Yes, because it was. It was completely unacceptable. I hate, like, I know that we do this podcasting kind of on the side, but I still hate, like, a lack of professionalism, like, especially when it's from me. And I told Rollo...
Lack of professionalism.
I was gonna say you must hate having to work with me if you hate a lack of professionalism.
You're really stalling the Fagcast name.
Crazy. I love no professionalism.
No, I don't mean professionalism as in like on air professionalism. I mean like setting it a time. And
yeah, I don't have any of that either.
Well, something's gotten us through 2 years.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I don't really know what
a lot
it is.
Of clue.
It's a. I was gonna say it's a cocktail of drug abuse and depression.
At any rate, Rollo texted me. So last night, I'm just like hanging out, making tacos, and Rollo texts me. He's like, "All right, you about ready?" And I was like,
"I hate." Fuck. By the way, Carr, sometimes you text me that, and it makes me nervous. Like, yeah. I hate that. I hate the "Are you almost ready?" text because yeah. I either, of course, I'm almost ready, or I've forgotten entirely.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, it turns out I've forgotten entirely. Not only had I forgotten entirely, but I had texted him that yes, I would be on the episode. Maybe 18 hours prior.
You did.
It turns out I was hammered, and I just said, yeah, of course, but like totally forgot about it.
You did. And again, I tried to sidestep you, I believe, was part of the strategy there, too. Well.
I did that recently, and luckily, somebody just like Skypes me on my phone and goes, "So we going right now?" And I'm like, "Oh fuck!" and everything, and it turned out to be like one of my best appearances ever.
Oh nice,
Christ!
Yeah, I was like, "Oh, this is cool. All right, I might release."
This is the
that
part where Rollo would point out that last night was my best appearance ever on the Rollin' Slappy Show because I wasn't on it. I'm just gonna get out ahead of that one.
It would be kind of good now if you started doing this to them regularly. Like, you started regularly being like, "Oh, shit, sorry, guys, forgot again." And they're like, "Dude, again,
how many times
really?"
I can get away with it?
How many times do you think, yeah, how many times could you, three, right? It would be three times,
yeah,
and then
three.
You would not be getting any invites anymore.
Seems reasonable, yeah.
Yeah, fair enough.
I've just been dropping the ball left and right. I feel like there's, like, a bunch of shit that I've been supposed to be doing, and I just haven't done it, and, like, yeah, whatever.
Is that a Carolina Hurricanes thing behind you?
Yeah, bro.
Which one, what is that?
Yeah, Carolina Hurricane.
Like no, but like a window, like for a car window kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a car window flag.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
For all those times, you need to.
For all those times when it's time
that.
To represent the Canes.
Uh huh. When was the last time you used
Rod
that?
Is Rod Brindamore the current head coach of that team?
Yeah. which he was on the they won the Stanley Cup my senior year of high school, which was awesome. And that's when that flag's from.
Oh wow.
And he was on that team.
I mostly remember him playing, I think, on the Flyers.
Yeah, was that
back when I used to follow hockey? Back when Jen and I had season tickets to the Panthers, so we were like,
oh wow,
we were up on it. I knew, you know, who the fourth liners were on pretty much every team.
You knew girth and length of all the fourth liners.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, and now I couldn't even tell you who's leading the league in scoring. I'm assuming it's Ovechkin, but you know, who knows?
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of fell out of hockey, and just it's difficult to follow hockey and baseball in the same year, and it's just been baseball for me for like the last decade.
Yes.
And that's the longest season too. I mean, 162.
I know. Well, they're both like, there's just so many games in both seasons. Like, I can't.
82 games. Yeah. And then the playoffs are fucking forever.
It's ridiculous. I mean, I love it when I'm into it, but when I'm not, like, holy shit, this is a lot, guys.
Yeah. That, I mean, I think one year we had season tickets and went to almost all of the 41 Panther home games, and they won 9.
That's brutal.
Yeah, we were real fans.
That's every season I've ever owned a Mets. every time I've ever owned a Mets season pass, that's how it's been.
Yeah. Well, when I first started going to the Nationals games, it was, God, they were freaking horrible.
Did you ever get a season pass? Do you like the season pass?
For the Nats? I never did, because you could scalp the tickets for like, I mean, when I lived there, they were so bad that there was no reason to get a season pass. You could just, they'd almost pay you to walk in the stadium.
There was one, the first season that I started watching baseball, you could just go on SeatGeek and get a Mets ticket for $3.
Yeah.
And you could waltz in. It was amazing. Those are the good days.
You could usually get Rockies tickets for $5 or $10 right before pitch. When I lived there, that was awesome. That was a lot of fun. Because the Rockies are never like that great, but the stadium is so conducive to home runs that you're going to go just watch people crush it for, you know, 9 innings.
That's what you would do, right?
Awesome. Does Aaron like baseball? Because if he does, I'm assuming he's a Red Sox fan, and that just makes
sense. Yeah, I can't relate to any of this talk of cheap tickets to any sporting event.
Yeah.
It's like $169 for like obstructed view at Fenway. So
last time I went to a Yankee game, I sat in the outfield, and it was, I think, $140.
Oh my God.
Yep.
Jesus.
But I did sit right behind Aaron Judge, and I'm just like, holy fuck, that dude is huge.
Oh, that dude
he's an enormous human being.
That guy's at the top of the girth chart for sure.
2017 MVP.
Yeah, really massive. The diameter. I'd really would like to get some numbers on the diameter of that guy.
Oh yeah, it's like a space shuttle.
So what are we talking about? What are we talking about, boys?
Not a thing. What do you got? What's been bothering you lately?
So just as I've been doing for the last month, I have not been contributing to the brainstorming for episode topics or anything. So yeah, we're just
no. I distinctly have decided let's move more into not planning anything. So I'm glad you're on board with that.
I've not only been thinking that, I've been doing that.
The last time that we did no planning, I fucking ended up on this weird conspiratorial website for this guy it just happened to be great. So
the Tartarian.
How was that? Yeah, did you hear that one? What'd you think about that one?
Well, you know that I love the Tartarian conspiracy.
Why do you love it?
It's just it's just odd. It's just really weird. I mean, you know, they talk about, and I've watched hours of videos on this. Okay, so I have time at work. All right,
of course.
Like,
that's just a weird one. I would not have expected this to be the one that you. No, it's not. It's like a weird historical conspiracy theory about whether or not this place existed.
Oh, okay.
I think I remember telling you guys in private chat that one night I ate like a whole edible and then ended up like talking to Paz, asking Paz about questions about whether whether like the modern European Romi are descendants of the Tartarians.
Yeah. So that was something.
But the Tartarian thing isn't as interesting as the mud flood thing, because like when I go to New York, I stay on Bleecker. And
the mud flood.
Yeah, the mud flood. Let him.
Okay. There's this theory that not long ago, maybe a century and a half ago, there was this huge mud flood all over the world where it just basically buried buildings. Like the buildings, a lot of the buildings that we see in big cities used to be taller, and actually their entrances right now are under the ground.
No way.
And so like they've done this excavation, and I know that Paz said that some of it could have been photoshopped, and some of it could be, but some of the pictures I've seen don't look photoshopped. But even if you go to New York, I don't know about this bird, have you ever walked down the street in New York and you look at a building and you see like a window on the ground floor?
Oh, yeah.
That goes under the ground?
Well, when we met Sal and we went to Chinatown, that's the best example of it. If you go to Chinatown, it's like what they said, like LA, where it's just like the streets are almost at like they're at the probably the steepest angle you could get before you can't drive a car up it in some of these areas. It is really interesting. And the buildings are just half of the building is under the ground.
Yeah. And that's the thing is, and the whole theory is that at one time there was this huge flood and mud just came in and they built on top of the mud, and like the buildings are like two or three floors maybe underground, and they just sealed them off, used
the piers and pilings and foundations from the previous buildings and built just on top of them.
Or it could be just that the building is now shorter because the elevation of the street is up. And like when you walked out, like I noticed it right on the street where the Soho Forum is. Mm-hmm. You walk down,
yep,
and there are windows that on the ground floor that are halfway underground.
Yeah, Hunter College is another one where the building's built into the ground.
Architect did that?
Yeah, it is weird. That is weird.
It's a really odd theory.
Yeah, that is weird.
But it makes sense, you know? If you look, it's like, who built that? Who decided that they were going to make the window go 6 feet underground?
Did nobody notice a big mud flood? Like, there's no...
Well, the theory is that they wrote it all out of history.
That seems like, why? Why would you write it out?
One of the videos I saw showed like these actual videos of all these buildings in Toronto that were these amazing megalithic buildings, you know, with the entrances that are 30 feet high, stuff like that. And they just tore them down and they, you know, put more modern architecture in there. And, you know, for the most part, modern architecture is just boring and, you know, almost Soviet inspired, you know, just a little bit of spice on it or something like that. And it's like, why? And the question they ask is, why would they get rid of this beautiful architecture? And they harken back to, I think it's the World's Fair in St. Louis of 1914 or 1918. I can't remember. And you look at the buildings that they had built for it, or the buildings they had used for it, and they were these unbelievable classic mega structures, you know, that are just classical looking. And they just, why would they tear all this stuff down? And the whole theory is they tore it down so that they would hide this history of, you know, because they mostly say that it was, they called those Tartarian buildings, that these Tartars, they're the ones who are responsible for building
there,
it.
Oh, so it's like a way to link the two theories together?
Yeah, and they say, you know, the reason why they're 35 feet high and everything is because you guys all know giant theory.
Yeah.
Sure.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, and they're saying that, like, there's this, and on one of them has this painting that's, like, 250 years old, and it's Indians having a war in North America, and they're firing cannons from castles.
What?
Yeah. So it's like, there's a lot of weird stuff out there, man, that you look at it and you're like, what the hell is going on here? It was like that picture of that Indian. I think it's from, it's a picture of Native Americans from like 1937 or 36. And I forget what they're in. I think they might be in a boat. And one guy is obviously texting on a phone. And it's Christ. Like, and you're just like, what?
Hey, and Aaron, can you stop huffing into the microphone, please?
Sorry.
Can you put the glue down?
Yeah, Jesus Christ. That was like, it was a growing aggravation. 5 minutes.
I'm sorry.
He's huffing.
But you know, but most of this stuff, you know, is theory. But I mean, when I go to New York and I see, like, I go around Atlanta, I don't see the structures like that, because remember, Atlanta got burnt to the ground allegedly in the 1860s.
Didn't happen.
Why'd you say allegedly there?
It didn't happen.
Well, because how do you know it did happen? You weren't there.
Yes. Half is great, because half of our listeners are like, yes, and the other half are like, no.
Like, what the hell is wrong with him? Isn't he the sober guy who, like, interviews, like, professors and all this shit?
No, yeah. No, you are not the sober. No, you are not the. You're not. Yeah,
this
you're
is actually me.
You're not the. You're not the sober one.
Yeah. Oh, I'm definitely not the sober one. But yeah. But when I go, but the whole thing when I go to New York and I see those buildings where the, I mean, I really would like an explanation from, you know, like, to look at the architect original plans of these buildings,
yeah,
and see why there are, you know, windows 6 feet underground.
Mm-hmm. And there, the, really, and that's the thing. You're right. They are far underground. They're, it's, yeah, not. It's not like, I don't know, some people, maybe if you haven't been to New York or you haven't seen what he's talking about, it's not like the window is halfway into the ground. No, no, no. There's probably 3 or 4 feet of building to get to the start of the window for some of these buildings. They're really far down. Some of them maybe 12 feet to the ground. I mean, it's ridiculous.
And even the ones that are like 3 feet above the ground and 3 feet under the ground, I mean, why would an architect do that? Because say some kids are just screwing around on the street and they just kick it by accident. You're, I mean, how easy is it to break those windows? Or you're just, a basketball hits them. It, yeah, just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it is weird when you think about that. That is a strange one. I think the most interesting part about the history conspiracy theories is because it really tests, like, whether or not history is reliable in the first place. That was what was so interesting about the Tartarian thing to me, is there's enough information there that you could look at it and you could go, okay, is this real history, or is this just sort of Europeans not understanding how, I guess they were Mongolians, but I'm not 100% sure how their politics system worked. I don't know. But it is really weird when, I love alt history because you have to, it forces you to go, okay, fine, I won't consider it from this perspective that has been written about for the past 1,000 years. What about the perspectives of the people who are there? This weird, though, because the Tartarian thing, at least from what I read, it
well, I mean, that article, that person was obviously, that person had taken the whole bottle of red pills, not just.
That was crazy, right? That was completely nuts.
Was he like, did he get to the truth of the wine earth?
He got to Jewish conspiracy theories, and he got to, like, he called the Pope Jewish. It was amazing.
Man, you know, yeah, everybody loves alt history until you start going, 6 million is a really large number. Yes! How many ovens are there?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Because the thing about alt history is there's definitely some Nazi influence in some parts of it. Because it's alt.
You guys remember that King of the Hill meme I sent you, right?
Oh, God.
That was like last night. Oh, the one is like,
oh,
Bobby,
yes,
put that calculator down.
Oh, my God, yeah.
I don't care how many ovens there were. They're our greatest ally.
Jesus Christ. Yeah, that was, yeah, when he, see, that's the weird thing about, like, the conspiracy theory community is you could wade into a, you, like, you don't know which guys hate Jews and which guys don't. It's, do you know what I mean? Like, you could be reading one of these conspiracy theories, and, like, it could be like, okay, all right, fine, the Federal Reserve got, and the Jews, like, you know, yeah, like it, like, comes out of nowhere.
You in that direction.
See, the weird thing about, like, that, I don't know what you want to call it, I don't know, but whatever that is, it always sneaks up on you. It's always like, yeah, the writers are like, all right, well, if they believe this, they're going to be, like, nodding their heads, like, okay, and if they don't believe it, maybe it'll slip past them. I don't know.
Well, a lot of times, like, the one you were reading, I mean, yeah, it was out there and everything, but I was following it and everything. And then it was like, you get like 80% done, and it was like, and here comes the Jew talk.
Yep. Yeah. And I really, I swear I was reading that article and I was like, there's no way it's going to get to Jew stuff. It would have done it already. And then it got to the Jew stuff really right when I wasn't expecting it. Yeah.
It's,
it was
just
really
irritating
bad,
because, like, I want to hear something fresh and new. And then it's like, as soon as they bring that up, it's like, I know where this is going. Like, I just know where it's going. What, like, whatever you believe one way or the other, it's just boring after a while.
Yeah, it was bad.
I was talking to somebody I work with today, and he's one of those guys that we could have a conversation with about the Federal Reserve, things like that. And then he started bringing up today how Nelson Mandela, Jesse Jackson, this is a black dude from up in New York, Nelson Mandela, Jesse Jackson, Gandhi, that they're all secret Freemasons.
Oh, yeah.
I'm just like, oh, now we're, and now, now we've hit takeoff. Let's go.
Yeah. Yeah, that's crazy.
You just quietly fold the trade table up and buckle.
Just crazy. It's like buckle in, because here we go. And he, and believe it or not, he said the Pope is a Freemason. It was just and of
the
course,
Pope is a Freemason. The Pope is a Freemason is one that, like, okay, fine. Like, I've heard that one before. The Pope is Jewish is one that I've definitely not heard.
That's
before.
Probably my favorite one so far, without just on first blush, and I think I'm just gonna run with it.
Did you, Pete? What did you think about the fact that the guy was like also like majorly a vegan? Do you remember that part? Like, there's a quote. I'm gonna read it again because it is a beautiful quote. Veganism is not only essential for the well-being of all animals, it is also vital for the spiritual and physical health of humans. It is a necessary element in the advancement of human consciousness. With this in mind, it is an easy step to take. And there's a picture of some kind of swan flying in the distance. Beautiful quote.
I'm going to give you a theory that, I mean, take it or leave it. I really honestly believe that if the whole population of the United States, 80 to 90% of their diet was meat, they would have revolted against the government already.
Because of the testosterone levels? Yeah.
I am like I am all the time. Because I am eating 80 to 90% animal flesh. I mean, when I've done the vegan thing and I've done the vegetarian thing, and I chill out. I become docile. I meditate once a day now. I want to meditate 4 or 5 times a day and everything. And I don't think we're at that point in history where docile is going to help.
No, not at all.
So what do you need to be, like, very aggressive? So, like, 90% meat, chilling out, I lamb, mean,
10% burgers. Coke.
Yeah.
10% Coke.
Stimulant animal wish. Fat.
Sure.
I wish. I think 90% meat and, like, 10% MDMA, that's a good balance.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
You could still think through a lot of things, but you're still, like, excited to... really hate those who obviously hate you.
I'm interested in your thoughts, like, from a sociological point of view. Do you think there isn't a concerted effort to kind of make us more docile?
Oh, it's so obvious. I mean, when you look at, like, what they tell us to eat, I mean, it's exactly what I said. You know, it's like, oh, don't eat so much meat. It's, you know, it's, that's really bad for your heart and everything. And then you read studies, and it's like you can see the studies that are actually just total bullshit. And right. They're like, well, this really isn't backed up by anything. And then you look at the studies that, like, people who've been doing the carnivore diet for 10 and 12 years have done. Like, when I had my blood work done recently at the doctor, my diet, probably the 3 months before I did that, was 95% meat, and the other 5% was, like, olives and eggs.
Oh, I like that. That's a good diet.
Yeah. And, you know, and most of my meat intake is either prime rib, ground beef, and ribeye, and some pork belly. I think pork belly is great. I think you need to get animal fat too. And I think my cholesterol was 169. You know, nice. the bad cholesterol. And my doctor's like, how? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, flip the people who are coming in here whose bad, you know, whose bad cholesterol is 400, they drink soda. Mm. You know, they drink all this frigging crap. You know, and
you came in with 169. You said, doc.
Sorry, man. You know, and he told me like 3 years ago, I came in there and I think it was around 200. And he's like, I want you to go for a cardiac scoring test. I can't remember what it's called, but they basically do like an MRI of your heart to see how much plaque is in there.
Ugh.
And I went up there and I did it and it was zero.
No plaque? Hmm.
None.
I probably got a lot of plaque.
A little plaque's good.
A lot of plaque. I probably got. Oh, Carr, you with all those olives, you got a lot of plaque. I got to tell you, but
yeah, maybe.
Yeah, Aaron, we already know.
Good fat.
That's what's dragging me down in rec volleyball.
Well, I'm sick and tired of talking about my diet.
How is volleyball going, champ? How's it going?
Well, despite my ongoing struggles with the front office to update the fucking spreadsheet.
Hold on. Let's begin from the beginning. You've been doing this on Twitter, but I don't think you've once talked about your situations on the air.
No, because it gets me super irritated.
Yeah, which is why we're going to have to talk about that now. So, like,
that makes for a good episode.
You've been a volleyball guy, right? You've been playing volleyball, you know, with the crew on the beach, probably, you know, having a good time. Yeah.
Let me know when you want to talk about the coronavirus.
We can't talk about the coronavirus because the Gaslight Hour already did a roundtable about the coronavirus. If we do that, we're gonna step all over.
Just direct competition.
So let's do one about AIDS. Let's
crush the Gaslight Hour.
Yeah. Let's do one about Reagan creating AIDS in a Canadian bioweapons facility in 1981.
You guys know Richard Grove, right? TragedyandHope.com.
No.
Yeah. I'll give you the 6 points about the coronavirus that he sent me today if you guys want at any time.
Okay, we'll hold that. Carr, sure. Volleyball standings, where are you sitting at?
Well, we're right on the cusp of the playoffs, and they won't update the fucking spreadsheet, which is really, really irritating. So I don't know if we're going to be in the playoffs. Next week is our last week, so it's really getting down to it.
Do you ever think about emailing somebody, calling, hey, you want to call them right now? Can we call the office right now?
I mean,
I'll call him.
Yeah. Let Aaron call him. Let Aaron call the office. Let Aaron call the office.
If you fucking faggots don't update the fucking spreadsheet.
The spreadsheet, you know what I'm talking about.
Carr Campus volleyball spreadsheet. And everybody's like, who's Carr Campus?
Yeah, well, here's the thing. It's like, you know, I'm not like a super angry dude, but I have stopped by there a couple times and gently offered my input on why, on you know, maybe perhaps updating the spreadsheet.
What the hell does that mean? What does that mean? So you went into
they'll know exactly who sent me.
I swing by and I say, hey,
you swing by. Where do you swing by? Where are you swinging? Where are you swinging?
The front desk.
Hey, bro, if you don't update your spreadsheet, I'm going to fucking kill your family.
I'm going to fuck you. I'm going to fuck your skull until you're dead.
FYI. That's like in an email with just like the subject line, FYI.
Jesus Christ, man. I don't understand. This is so difficult. You go to the office. And yes. Phyllis is behind the desk, and you go, Phyllis, listen, it's been 3 fucking weeks, Phyllis. Update that spreadsheet.
I'll warm it up. I'll be like,
okay.
I'll be like,
hey, Phil.
You know, how's your day going?
She's like, I'm great. Nice, how are you? Yeah, so you ask her how she's doing. Yeah, well, maybe that's why you're not getting anywhere, because you're treating these people like people.
I know, and here's the problem, is that I'm going to do that until the rage gets so pent up, and then I'm just going to explode.
You going to hit somebody? Are you going to hit Phyllis? Are you going to beat this one up?
I mean, I'm not yet. I mean, I'm not yet.
Okay.
But I tell you, if we miss the playoffs because of a spreadsheet error, because they haven't been updating it, I'll probably freak out.
So what you're implying with a light flex is that you are within playoff range.
Well, yeah, and we arguably are like one of the higher seeds, but I don't know because the goddamn spreadsheet won't get updated.
Let me ask you this: as your psychologist,
are you
the only one angry about this?
Admittedly, yes.
All right.
Everyone else seems to be letting it slide, and I get really tweaked about it every time. In fact, after this episode,
I'm
going to go
down
there.
Yeah,
you seem
very
warming up, and then somebody's going to be like, "Oh, are we going to make the playoffs?" And then I'm going to fucking build that soapbox, scramble up on it, and then completely lose track of volleyball that I'm supposed to be warming up.
I want everybody to keep in mind that Carr is doing this while wearing volleyball shorts.
Yeah.
like a giant G word. You get a smoothie while you're down there too?
Really irritating. No, I'm not. I'm down there for business, not pleasure. Aaron.
Christ. Yeah, Aaron. All right, I'm going to have to flip my chicken over. Give me like 2 seconds. Aaron, take the wheel.
Oh, jeez. That was a mistake.
Yeah, you've been pretty quiet since I called you out on the microphone. Are your feelings hurt or
A little bit, but I'm mostly just listening.
Okay.
I'm a listener.
Yeah.
Fucking taking account of everything you say.
Yeah. That's what I fear. That's what I fear.
Yeah, I don't have a whole lot going on. I think got Thaddeus Russell's book inspired by Pete's episode with him.
Oh, which, yeah.
Renegade History or
such? Yeah, Renegade History.
Yeah. How long is that?
It's a pretty girthy book.
Yeah.
That's 350 to 400, I think.
Yeah. And I'm doing Audible.
Okay.
I'm autistic.
That's the way I did it. That's the way I did it, and I did it in a few days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been doing it like 10-15 minutes at a time.
It's engaging. I mean, there's some history there that you're not going to hear anywhere.
Yeah,
else,
exactly. But. That's what I've gleaned from this book is there are so many things that we could be talking about right now. Like, you know how everybody wants to use people as an inspiration, historical figures and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Well, there are so many historical figures out there that all of these activists could be using as inspiration.
Like me as far in 30 as like, years.
Exactly.
You're going to look back one day and say that car can't fit.
There is a whole chapter about gay people. So
yeah.
Specifically playing volleyball. Yeah, that's true. Gay volleyball
gay
players.
Gay volleyball rights. That was the unsung '60s movement was gay volleyballer rights.
But like, you know, what we would now call like transgender pioneers, you know, female business owners. But I'm noticing a pattern that all of those people operated outside of the state. So there's
Like who?
I mean, I don't know any specific names. I don't have that mental capacity, Bird. Come on.
Okay. I was going to say, because the first person I thought of was Elizabeth Warren.
Apparently there was a high percentage of females that operated like taverns back in the Revolutionary period.
Oh, nice.
And, you know, and he mentions names, but like, you know, and...
The name.
I know. But, you know, those taverns, they catered to literally everybody. They were the most eclectic group of people that, you know, you can't find even right now. Like you couldn't walk into a bar and see like poor people, gays, you know, trans.
God, I hope not.
I was gonna say, unless you live where I live, because yes, you can. That's probably the only place.
Hear about them.
That's true. It's probably one of the only cities where that is the case.
Yeah.
Well, nobody talks about it in Atlanta either. I mean, it's just nobody really cares. I mean.
But there was this whole underground, and I don't even know if it was underground because like throughout the book, he makes it pretty clear that, you know, he's narrating it as though John Adams is walking down the streets of Philadelphia, and what would he see? And he would see prostitutes like, you know, fucking flashing them. He would see like gay guys showing their dicks, propositioning other gay guys, and like,
oi, mate.
But yeah,
hello.
This is pre-revolution.
Yeah, take a look at the musket.
And during. Pre-revolution.
This is pre-revolution. It's amazing.
Yeah. And we've been taught our whole lives that, like, you know, the further back in time you go, the more conservative it is.
Oh, that's
but
not true. Yeah, that ain't even close to true.
That's not the case at all.
Nah, they were partying back in the day. I think we're honestly, if you look at throughout history, we probably are in one of the most conservative periods of human history ever, despite
not even
the fact
conservative Puritan.
I completely agree with you. Yeah, there's a really large minority of radicals who are trying to push us in a given direction. I would say forward, but I don't want to use that. But for the most part, puritanic. We live in a very puritanical culture, far more than most of history would let you know people were like.
Like, think of the most libertine person you know.
You.
They don't hold a candle to anybody, any of those people in that book
that
Thaddeus mentions. They don't hold a candle to them.
Well, here's something that is interesting. People are talking about, we need this libertarian revolution. And I've heard people say, you know, well, if it's not conservative, if it's not, you know, steeped in values, it's not going to happen. But if you look in American history, the ones who made the you know, the greatest changes, especially culturally, they weren't conservatives. I mean, they were the last thing they were conservatives. So, yes. You know, if you're, you know, like Hoppe, I like a lot of what Hoppe has to say, but his whole thing about, oh, libertarian has to be ultra conservative. Well, conservatives have never changed culture. They've never changed, you know, they've also never changed anything.
Like, I mean, what the founders does that even
weren't
mean?
Conservatives. Some of them were.
And in Democracy, A God That Failed, he even allows for, you know, covenant communities that cater to libertinism, like not libertarianism, but it's libertinism.
It's just weird to me that you would go, if you're, first of all, libertarians, sure, but anarchist specifically, conservatism is a political position. So either you're an anarchist or you take a political position. You can do one or the other. You cannot do both. If it's cultural conservatism, I don't know what Hoppe is speaking about because he's a German. Is he talking about the American brand of culture conservatism? Is he talking about the German brand of culture conservatism?
I think nowadays there's a lot of overlap.
There's really not. I mean, if you look at the things that are going, I mean, but you have to remember, like you just said, puritanical. We live in a country that has had puritanical influences. Most of the world has not had puritanical influences. People think differently than we do here.
Especially in my area.
Yeah.
Still see it nowadays.
Right. I mean, we are a country that whose laws were written largely by people who were born of Puritans. It's different than the rest of the world, which mostly deals with, I mean, in Europe, it mostly still deals with the underpinnings of the Enlightenment and Christendom. And, I, it's just different. So I don't know. I never understood that. If you're an anarchist, you want to destroy as many hierarchies as possible. Whether or not, I don't understand your social position as to, oh, well, you know, maybe I don't like when two guys get married. I don't care. That's not a thing. You and I can disagree about that and still disable every single hierarchy that we possibly can. That's all that seems to matter to me. If it's a kind of political conservatism where it starts to go into, well, we need a border wall because it will be less expensive if we... I mean, that's statism, just enrobed. And if you're an anarchist, you have to accept the fact that certain things are going to happen while the state still exists. If being a conservative is a political position, I close. I don't know.
I like what Hornberger says about the whole argument that you can't have more open borders as long as you have a welfare state. He said, well, then you can rightly say you can't end the war on drugs until you end Medicaid, Medicare, because people can get messed up and fucked up on drugs, and then they'll abuse the Medicare system.
Also,
and the only argument I can think of against that is you're going to have to make a nationalistic argument. Well, at least those people,
right,
they're Americans.
Right. Because the economic argument, I don't want to pay I don't want these people coming in because they make my life more expensive through taxes. I'm sorry, buddy. If you're an anarchist, you either shouldn't be paying them or you should accept that as a consequence until you stop paying them. I don't know what that has to do with other people coming in.
That option never enters their mind.
That's the thing. It's not
your income.
That's not an option. But that's not an option. Either you go by the book, you go by what anarchism says, or you accept for whatever reason you need to. Maybe you have kids and you don't want the state to come to your fucking door and take you away because you'd rather it. Fine, perfectly fine. But that's not conservatism. That is survival. That's fine. That's okay. But this, like, well, since I have to pay taxes, then we might as well have a... No, you don't...
We might as well expand the we might as well expand the police state.
Right.
People, you know, a 100-mile fucking radius from the border where anybody can be stopped.
I don't
checked,
even... And even
American citizens.
Beyond that, even a single guy in an outfit going over to that area of the world and putting one pike in the ground where they can start building that fence is already too far. That's already too much state action. So either you accept that they're going to act that way and you keep paying them because you have higher priorities than dismantling the state and hierarchies, or you go, well, it ain't the fucking immigrants' fault.
Know it or not, those Hoppian arguments, they all come down to time preference. They have just as high a time preference as the socialist arguing for free college, free healthcare. Just as high time preference.
No, but they'll tell you, they will argue that their time preference is actually low because by building the wall, they understand that they're extending out their time preference in order to achieve what they want.
I was gonna say, ain't it funny how logic ain't real and anybody can do whatever the fuck they want with it?
There'll be a lot of short-term repercussions, but in the long run,
I've decided it's better. It's like, okay, then it's not really science anymore, is it?
My favorite is the whole net taxpayer argument, which I think
that's amazing.
Absolutely destroys.
Which again,
we're not going to be covering because it's so irritating.
Which again, by the way, admits the individual who's saying it admits that they have to be a taxpayer, and you do not have to be a taxpayer. I'm sorry. Well, the government will come and kill it. Sorry, you don't have to. You can fucking say not doing it.
How many deductions did you take while we're itemizing your virtue? How many?
That's true too. That's true too. Beyond the idea you don't have to pay taxes, you really should be at least doing deductions. At the very least.
You know what the funny thing is? People make the argument like, if you don't pay taxes, you don't get to use the roads. It's like, income tax doesn't pay for the roads. In my state, gasoline pays for the road, and I drive every day.
I'll do you one better. Tax, you know what I tell those people? Actually, you know what? I'm going to use all those public services anyways, and I'm going to obfuscate as much of my income as possible. There's not a damn thing you can do about it.
Right,
because fuck.
Yeah, that would be the correct response. Yourself. That's for the statist. These anarchists who go, well, you gotta pay taxes. It's by force. It's like, it is by force. Doesn't mean you have to comply. You can take that beating. You just won't. You just value yourself, and so you'd rather build up a fucking wall than take a hit to the face for yourself and everybody else. That's ultimately what it is.
It's a risk-reward scenario that each anarchist takes.
That's it.
You know, how much of my income am I willing to obfuscate? How much am I willing to
bend
the truth in my tax return?
Right. Listen, I pay taxes. I haven't yet. I mean, I haven't yet this year. I haven't yet this year, and we'll see. Hopefully, I get to it. Maybe, but like I've done it before. I'm sure all of us have done it before. I'm not saying you're a bad anarchist if you do that. What I'm saying is you've made a pragmatic choice. Don't put that on anybody else.
And pragmatism has nothing to do with virtue.
No. You're making a decision. Look, if you have kids you want to raise, and so you got to pay taxes because you're afraid some fucking thug will come to your door and kill you if you don't do that, go pay your taxes. That's cool. Don't blame the immigrants that your taxes are getting higher, and so you have to keep paying them. You've made your choice. You've made your choice.
It's deep-seated jealousy.
We talk about personal responsibility. I think libertarianism is ultimately like you could boil it down to one general idea, and it's personal responsibility. And it ultimately, that's what the whole conversation is. There are people who want to continue to abdicate their own personal responsibility. You chose to pay those taxes. You can, number one, not pay them, or number two, accept that you must pay them, value your own goals higher, and stop blaming anybody else for the fact that you put money in that envelope and sent it to the fucking government. That is your issue. That's not anybody else's.
You're missing the other option, voting really hard.
Yes. You could vote really hard for someone like Andrew Yang, who will somehow decrease our taxes and also give us money back, apparently. You could do that. Sure. That sounds great.
Nobody sounds more statist than a bordertarian.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
More statist. It's like, we need the state to protect the welfare state.
What's amazing about people like that is that
they're willing to friggin' unleash the police state so they can protect the welfare state. Why? Because your mom is benefiting from the welfare state, your dad, your brother, who's a complete fuck up.
Those people aren't anarchists. They're just not anarchists. What they have done is they have decided after they figured out what the world looked like to be an anarchist.
After they figure out how to go about fixing their own situation.
No. What I mean is, a border is what? A border is a government property, right? I mean, ultimately, you could go, on the border, it's owned by individuals. No, it's not. Ultimately, they're citizens of the United States of America, and so their property ultimately, coming down to it, is property of the state, and so it's identified with the state. You have decided, while being an anarchist, also to adopt those specific borders for some reason. You've acknowledged that those borders are in some way legitimate in the first place, and I can't wrap my head around that one either.
I mean, I see anarchists, you know, arguing like I said today, there were anarchists who were like, we have to do something to stop the stock market from crashing. I'm like, this is where I think one of the most brilliant libertarians on the planet right now is Jeff Deist. Because Jeff Deist says, show me a really bad libertarian and I'll show you someone who doesn't understand basic economics. And that's what it comes down to. Whenever you see a libertarian who's just like a SJW libertarian, or, you know, just these screwball libertarians that care more about, I think the Nazis are trying to take over the Libertarian Party. These people just, I mean, they're retards. They don't, and they all are just terrible on economics. Or if they are good on economics, they've abandoned it for something else. For they've prioritized it low. Because I know Bird always shits on economics and everything, but I know he knows it's important. You know, because all economics is interaction.
Yeah, right.
Between people.
Yeah.
You know, and
well, I think that highlights just kind of the difference between the social anarchists or social minarchists and the market anarchists and market minarchists, where a lot of the market anarchists would just say, look, I'm going to participate socially, whatever I want to participate in.
Yeah.
But you can't just force stuff because that's going to create weird shit. Like you have to let people make their own decisions, you know, that they perceive to benefit themselves, provided they abide by the rules of, you know, say property rights.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why I've kind of softened my tone on left anarchists, non-Marxist left anarchists.
Hi.
yeah.
Well, yeah, whatever. Whatever, Bird. But,
get out, Bird.
Like, it's because I've gotten into, like, reading Proudhon and,
Markets Not Capitalism yet? Is a great book.
Yeah. Oh, I picked it. When you did that interview, I managed to get a copy of it. Man, there's like Rothbard is in there. Carson is in there. William Gillis is in there, which is like he's kind of a meme, but I like him sometimes. Like there's a lot of different people in that text. It's really interesting. I recommend everybody pick it up if you want to see what. Because like you were saying, Aaron, you were going to say, I don't know about Marxist anarchists. I certainly don't either. But, I mean, people like Gary, they're, like, what would you call them? They're just left anarchists, most of them, right? Like, they're, how does he describe himself these days?
Syndicalists, mutualists.
I don't even think syndicalists. I've come around to them. I don't even know about syndicalists.
But I don't think they're violent.
Yeah, no, I don't even know about syndicalists. Most of these guys are like market anarchists. Most of them, yeah. I think, would probably have identified as market anarchists in one way or another. Anyway,
you know who else?
Really great.
You
book.
Know who's in there? And it's amazing the stuff that Voltairine de Cleyre.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my! She was a boss.
Oh, she was a boss. She was one of the boss. She was right around the same time as like Tucker and Spooner, right? Was she not?
Yeah, she was late 1800s, early 1900s.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. When
she
okay,
was
a little
really
later.
Going crazy in Philadelphia and going to communist meetings and destroying their arguments by destroying capitalism.
Yeah.
She would just like absolutely destroy capitalism, which she was destroying corporatism. She was destroying the progressive era basically. And then she'd get these Marxists and communists to agree with her. And then she'd be like, okay, and now this is the way it should be. And she just she'd start describing free markets, mm-hmm. freed markets. As you know, as Gary calls it, and it's just—I mean, it's amazing. It's yeah. I mean, one of the things that I've really stopped doing, and I was doing it for a while, is you know, the free market has taken 1 billion people out of poverty in the last 30 years.
Yeah, it's
that's not true.
Not true.
That's
not true.
That's not true at all.
Yeah. No.
Yeah, neoliberalism slash corporatism has done it.
Yes,
imagine if it actually was free market.
You know what's amazing about you, Pete, is you are one of the few people I know with a platform your size who has the balls to say that. There's a whole lot of people who would just go, well, you know, pass my, because of the anarchist thing. But that is so true. I really appreciate you saying that. That's a great way of kind of putting it into perspective, is some things that don't still work still do a lot of good. That's not really the point, is it?
Yeah, no, it's not. You know, and even Gary, when I asked him about that, even he said, well, you know, we have to explain that's not what we want. And I'm like, I'm at the point where I'm like, no, I'll just say, fuck neoliberalism.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, fuck corporatism. You know, I really honestly believe, and I've said this on you guys' show before, that I think it's a conspiracy against Africa to keep it poor by, you know, by the elites and everything. Yeah. You know, if you just unleash the markets, look what happens. Mm. Look what happens everywhere you unleash the markets, even if you only unleash them a little bit like they did in Asia. I mean, you know, think about that. Think about all the people that were pulled out of poverty in China while they're still under the Chinese fucking regime.
Yeah,
imagine
yeah.
if it was a free yeah. market.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Holy shit. They knocked off about 20 million of them, and they can finally start to live better, and it's still a hellhole, but it's something. Just because of a few markets. It's amazing.
I mean, but, you know, I'm not willing to... I'm not, you know, if you want to talk about that, I'll be like, yeah, that happened. But fuck neoliberalism and fuck corporatism.
Yeah, when communists come out and say, look how many people capitalism kills per year, I wish they would just be a little more specific.
Yeah.
Corporate neoliberalism that starves certain groups of people to privilege people like us. Yes, I agree. That is something that happens in the real world.
That's the other thing I've gleaned from my conversations with Marxists, communists, mutualists, syndicalists. We have a completely different language.
Yes.
Like a completely different vocabulary.
Yes, yes. I've learned the same thing. There's some words that I use that they use that we mean two completely different things, and yet we both agree with one another.
Voluntary, the word profit, the word capitalism. I mean, that's
slavery.
Yep.
There's a lot of language there that you have to. And it's funny because when it's articulated, I don't think a lot of it is that unreasonable. It's just like we're used to a whole different set of words with different values behind them than.
Yeah.
That. Yeah. I don't know. But yeah, I'm glad this turned into like a little. Coalition thing.
Semi-informative.
Yeah.
A little semi-informative powwow. That
was cute.
Went from Tartarian mud floods to, you know, economics, like real economics.
Did you finish that book?
What, Markets Not Anarchism?
Mm-hmm.
No, that's a long book. I mean, I'm going through it slowly.
It's long, but it's got everything you need. That's what's so interesting about it is
Sheldon's in there, man.
Sheldon Richmond is in there. Rothbard's in there. Like there's a lot of people in there. Like a lot of people who have very, very disparate views because I don't know. It's great that somebody like Gary can just take so many different individuals and pick the parts of their ideas that come together to make this very reasonable, logical, anarchistic system that will probably be the most efficient for transferring resources, will probably lead to the most liberty for individual people, and will probably lead to the least opportunity for certain people to bring a hierarchy back into shape. That's what I think, at least. I'm sure there's other people who disagree, but at the very least, I love the book. I'm like halfway through it.
Well, I know that Carr will buck against this, but I've heard a lot of people say that the term libertarianism is lost and needs to be abandoned. But these are some of the same people who won't say the same thing about capitalism. And when you understand the origins of the term and you understand what it's really come to mean to the majority of the world outside of the United States, it's a really good argument for saying, all right, this word just sucks. Mm-hmm. You know, this term just sucks.
That's the approach that I've taken recently is getting away from capitalism and saying, okay, you are like when I'm arguing with a Marxist, you are against the private ownership of capital goods.
Right.
Because capital goods has a whole subsection mm-hmm. meaning mm-hmm. to capitalism. And
yeah. And I'm willing to, like, you know, I guess one of the big dilemmas is, okay, I don't ever believe that this will happen. We wake up the next morning, the government's fallen, and now we're, you know, we're in anarchy or whatever like that. I mean, I think I've adopted recently that it's going to have to be through secession, nullification, decentralization, things like that. And I honestly believe that now. But in that case that, oh, there's no more state anymore, and now we're in anarcho-capitalism, these corporations and people who own or control huge swaths of the natural resources, what do you do with them?
Yep.
What do you do? They
can only control it if they are capable of defending it.
I'm not advocating seizure. But that was the thing. Like, but that was that. Those are ill-gotten gains. A lot of those gains are ill-gotten to begin with. I mean, a lot of them were enforced by the state. A lot of them were purchased from, especially if you talk about like the Midwest and the West Coast. Like a lot of that land is still government-owned. First of all,
Carr is very uncomfortable right now.
Yeah.
I'm not. I was looking down at my whiskey glass and I was like, man, I'm. Shouldn't be another one before volleyball.
I need some more whiskey.
As a subsidy, which it basically is, it's taking the place of what what would exist in a free market.
I suppose. I suppose.
How do those corporations cover that cost? In the absence of a state, how do they cover the cost of the legal system, security, whatever else they're subsidized with?
Yeah. You have someone like Ted Turner who right now, quote unquote, owns billions of acres of land in the United States.
Right.
What happens to him? What happens to him if there are no more government protections for him to do that?
Let me ask you a question.
I think you default to Ethics of Liberty Chapter 9, it's like, hey, if you haven't improved what the land you haven't improved upon, if someone moves upon that land and they improve upon it, it's theirs.
Yeah.
So let me ask you a question.
The homesteading principle.
I was going to say, in that kind of a situation where if something like that occurs, and of course this doesn't happen ever in history, but it's really for the theoretical part of it. If the state dissolves in an instant, I, in my opinion, I would look at it and go, nobody owns any land. This is the fresh start.
Except what you control.
That's what I mean. If you can exercise,
with a house on it, and right. you have a garden.
Yes, you can. Functionally, you own what you have the ability to keep control over. I think everybody's exactly. in agreement with that. But yeah, the idea that like if the state was to dissolve. So right now, I don't own a house, but let's say I do. Or one of you house owners, just help me make sure that I'm getting all of this right. In the situation where you own a house, who are you signing the contract with when you purchase the house? You're sending ownership from one person over to another, or maybe one group over to another group, right? That's fine so far. Now, in what sense do you own that property if the state dissolves?
I believe that I still have title over it.
No, I know you do. I agree with you. You have title over, but your piece of paper, in my opinion, has no value at all. It defaults to your ability to control that piece of land. I don't know why I should. Well, you know what I mean? I don't know why
well,
I
some
should.
Some people are going to argue, like the people who are landlords who have a property in their hometown, but they also have a property in another state. I guess they would argue that if they can hire somebody to protect and, you know, cause people not to homestead that property they have in another state, that it belongs to them. But then, you know,
that's like, how is that not
real?
Does it really? Right. Exactly. Does it really?
I think I'm on the other side. I think that, you can own any land that you have title to.
And let me just ask the question then would be, because this is not the same everywhere, because titles are created, right? Like you don't pluck them out of the ground. They're created by
titles are state.
Right.
Titles
is that not the case
of the state?
Yeah, that's one of the main arguments
that
I encounter.
Has to be the case.
No. I agree with you. It doesn't have to be the case, but you currently own a contract where that is indeed the case. And so, if the state was to dissolve instantly, what other side of that party can we trace back your ownership of that piece of land to? You know what I mean?
Well, regardless of governments, I mean, the recordation exists that my property's been surveyed back to the point where it was subdivided, and you could trace the ownership all the way back. That's what my title company did.
Hmm. That's fair.
But who is going to exist at that time to say that paperwork is legitimate?
Well, maybe nobody. And that's why you have title insurance. And so so in order for somebody to take over the property, they would have to have a higher claim. And
Carr, that I think the point about like I think your contract is null, but I think what you said about the fact that the contract demonstrates your residence over the area and the history of that area and how I think I'm satisfied with that. Like
I don't think that the contract is null because the contract was between me and another person.
But doesn't it go back originally? Like if we go back to the original moment of the creation of the piece of land, is that not state authorized?
Is that state authorized?
Yeah, I was gonna say like who is surveying the land and authorizing it as a
In as much as anything is, I guess. I mean, it wasn't really it's not like they bought it from the state of mine goes back to the Mexico probably.
Well, because a lot of places in this country are homesteaded, and so in some sense they were originally claimed by the state in order to then be distributed. So how do we I mean, in a really purely theoretical way, you can't, I don't think, if the state then dissolves, the original owner of that piece of property no longer exists. You still do. You still have a claim to it, but sort of the original right to that land is dissolved, and it becomes your own right.
It's who's using it. It's the theory. It may come down to, you might want to look this word up. It's called usufruct. U-S-U-F-R-U-C-T. And basically what that is, and Thomas Jefferson actually talked about this, is it's about use. If you're using it at that time, then you are entitled to keep using it. Once you abandon it, well, then there, you know, unless you're your immediate relative moves onto it and starts using it, then really you're abandoning it. And that's what it would sound like. I mean, maybe in anarcho-capitalist society, quote unquote, we would have an independent agency that we would pay to keep titles, maybe do that on the blockchain. Who the hell knows?
I've heard there's no reason why you couldn't do that. It's just, I guess I want to know where we start from.
You're wondering about the enforcement mechanism.
Yeah, I am worried about the enforcement mechanism.
This is the sort of thing that would be solved in all other aspects. I mean, if you believe in free market, free market, you know, principles, like, this is going to get solved in all aspects.
Yeah, I agree with
you. And I think that you would absolutely have the right to land. I mean, you come down to what is use? I mean, what if I own a parcel of land out in the middle of Wyoming, you know, 50 acres, and I use it to go camp once a year? I mean, is that use? I would say that as long as I have the title to the land and you know, this is what title insurance is for. The market already solved this problem.
Well, think about this too, okay? We're looking, you can use something that's happening now, and I won't get into any conspiracy theories. I'm just going to use the term coronavirus just because it's in the news. Okay, everybody's worried about coronavirus because there's these huge population areas where everybody's crammed into each other. I think I've read numbers where 85% of the population lives within like 100 miles of the coast.
Hmm. Yeah.
And then 15% of the population. Okay. Can you imagine, how do you solve this problem of all these people crushed together where they can spread disease to each other? Well, yeah, like Nevada. I think Nevada is like 75% owned by the government, quote unquote, owned by the government, because we know they can't own shit. But if you release all that stuff and you open it to homesteading, imagine how many, or, you know, land in Montana, land in Nebraska, all this stuff that's owned, quote unquote, owned by the government, you release it to homesteading, you're going to, I think a lot of those people who are on the coast are going to be like, okay, let's go in, you know, and grab an acre or two and everything, build a house. But you don't have that, you know, people don't have that option now because, you know, if you want to do that, well, first, either the government owns it or a bank owns it or something like that, which makes no sense. If you look after the Civil War, it's like before the Civil War, you could homestead. After the Civil War, you had to talk to a bank or something like that. You know, it's a freaking joke.
I think to some degree, you're right. But also to another degree, there's still a shitload of land that's not owned by the government. Now, it's out west. Now, it's probably the minority, but there's so much fucking land out there. I mean, you can go grab a parcel in Colorado for $2,000 if you want it. I mean, I don't know that the $2,000 is the barrier to entry. Like, that's what would open the floodgates necessarily. Now, you could say some of those.
But you're still going to have property tax, and you're still going to have all the, you know, still going to have all this stuff. Like, where my father-in-law lives in Indiana, he lives in the middle of South Indiana, where there's farmland. It's just millions of acres and everything. And if you drive down even the street that he lives on, some of the properties have like this blue sign in front of it, and the blue sign denotes that the people who live there, their family actually like settled it, and we're talking about like a couple centuries ago, everything like that. And as far as I know, they don't pay property tax. They don't do anything like that. I mean, these people they look like friggin' hicks, and they're wealthy as fuck. You know, but I mean, that's the way it really should be. I mean, because, you know, all right, $2,000 for, you tell me that in Colorado, I can go get a parcel of land for $2,000. I can move a fucking double wide onto it and I can live my life. I'm still paying property tax. I'm still tethered to the government. Fuck those people.
Well, you know,
why a lot of people don't do it.
My point was not necessarily about the morality of it with the government involvement. My point was just that financially you're paying, you know, maybe $2,000 and then maybe like $50 in property tax a year or something like that out there, because there's just nothing to maintain. There's just almost none. I could make the same argument about, you know, my neighborhood was homesteaded. Essentially a lot of it was homesteaded.
Idea brings up so many we could probably do hours on that, like the whole idea.
We could be here for hours really what talking
is,
about this.
Really, man. What is homesteading? This is not like we arrived on the Asian steppe 8,000 years ago. Like, this is like there's some groups of people kicking around in the area who do not live the same sort of settled down lifestyle, who just because of that doesn't mean that they don't own that land and prior. Not that I'm trying to do this whole thing, because, Carr, I know that's not where you want to take
well,
this.
Well, no,
but it is.
I'm just saying that we can go round and round on that.
Right, exactly.
At the end of the day, title insurance solved this problem like 2 centuries ago.
I guess we would have to do an episode on that, because
ownership norms. Ownership norms of the community around which you lay claim to.
Yes, that's all that's ultimately what I think is your culture group and the society around you ultimately. They don't determine what you own, but ultimately, I mean, in the way the real world works, they kind of could.
They determine the terms of that title.
Yeah, in a way, your society determines the rules you play by. I mean, if you play by your own rules, that's cool, but you're going to have people who've got a problem with you. And that's fine, too. But yeah, ultimately, I guess the reason why I wanted to bring up the beginning of this whole thing, like how do we actually know where the titles come from in the first place, is because that's at least a starting point. Because I agree with you, Carr, the culture and the market will figure out the problems that happen now, because that's what human beings do. They solve the problems now. I just would like us to start from a new, or maybe not even
also,
sort of a new point, but start from a point.
Also think about this functionally, how much land there is in the world and how few people there are in the world relatively.
The world couldn't even support as many people as all the land could. Like, everybody could have a huge
amount
of land.
You're going to have situations where people own land where they're not living there. Or else it's just going to be quote-unquote unknown. But at that point, why the hell do you care?
Well, that's why I think the idea of the commons is a good one, because it's like, yeah, you own your personal piece, you own your property, that's yours, and then there's these massive swaths of land that nobody could possibly take control of. There's just not enough people or not enough resources.
I don't like
whatever.
Where this is going.
I just mean to say that covers that. Like, unowned land is not necessarily a thing. It's sort of everybody owns it until one person exercises their use over it. It's not nobody owns land. If you and I go into the woods and both of us eat berries off a bush, who's going to tell us not to do that? Nobody. It's implied you can go and exercise your due over a piece of land. That's how
but
we
me,
get claims.
To me, that would
claims.
Mean that land is unowned. That wouldn't make it a public commons.
Oh, I seems to me that it would be the same thing. Unowned and public commons is the same idea. Just again, to lay down the point that if you go onto a piece of unoccupied land, it's not necessarily unowned. It's not necessarily owned by everybody. It's just unoccupied. So how do you?
Well, and then it would be open for homesteading.
I agree with you, but that's all land.
What if Bigfoot already lives on that land?
That's true.
That's the other question we have to think is, like, what other sentient beings own property, and how can we grapple with them? And do we owe them respect as children of God? Find out next week.
I did that to wrap it up because I gotta get going.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's go. Let's move. I was really good.
I love you guys, man. Always love talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you for letting us do a little libertarian stuff. Pete, quickly plugs and then you can get out of here.
Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast, libertarianinstitute.org. And from what everything I understand, May of this year, 2 months from now, the documentary The Monopoly on Violence will be released.
Ooh. Oh shit.
Wow.
May? When in May are we gonna get a chance to watch it at Childeberg?
Yeah, live screening.
That's my friggin' goal. My goal is to have it done by the time the LP convention is.
So you think we'll be able to get a live screen? Oh, are you going to screen it at the LP? Do you have any plans to do anything like that? Because we could host a private screening at Childeberg.
I don't like those people. No, I mean,
I don't either. I don't either.
We could do a live screening on a phone, like in my hatchback.
No, hold on. No, because somebody we know has to have a projector. Somebody we know.
Probably Jacob.
Some intrepid F word has to have a projector that we can use. Oh, I bet Paz has all kinds of things that project images.
Astral projectors.
Yeah. Hey, look. If the documentary is done by Childeberg, it'd be really cool if we could do like the sort of opening night screening. That would be.
Do you realize as of today, Scott's debate with Crystal is 2 months, exactly 2 months from today.
I forgot that was even happening.
Are you not coming to New York for that? You're not coming to New York? Oh, no, I know you are. Yeah, no, I know you are. Yep.
I bought your ticket, bitch.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, you did. It is going to be a wild night, because I'll tell you what, that's that's the start of my night. I'm going to that debate, and then we're leaving that debate, and we're doing whatever. It's going to get wild. Everybody should come to New York for that one. That's going to be crazy.
I'm just upset that they moved it to a Sunday. If it was still on a Monday, we could go to like Legion of Skanks or something like that.
Yeah. Sunday night is an inconvenient day.
We could still go to Legion of Skanks the next night because I'll be in New York. Yeah, still be in New York the next night.
I was going
to
say, what else am I doing? Let's do it. All right. Pete, thank you for gracing us with your presence. Aaron, thank you for gracing us with your presence. We really appreciate it.
Oh, am I getting kicked out?
Hopefully. You know, the listeners will be hearing from you a lot more in the future, let's just say.
We'll see.
By the way, congratulations. It's a shame that you're not homeless, but congratulations on landing that job with Go Fuck Yourself Industries. That's really cool. Private Acquisitions Director, that's interesting. We really appreciate it, GFY. Thanks for giving our boy a job.
Go Fuck Yourself LLC is all about customer service, and there are many customers.
Right, that's right.
It's an expanding franchise.
There you go.
The market is right.
All right, guys.
Everyone, wish me luck tonight in Rec League Volleyball, and particularly with the admin at the front desk. That's where the real challenges lie.
So here's the question, Carr. Because this episode goes out tomorrow from the time of recording, when will we find out the results?
Well, I don't know, anywhere between 3 and 4 weeks, on previous patterns.
All right. Well, everybody's already going to hear this episode by the time you've played your game, but I wish you luck, and I'm sure the listeners are with you.
Thank you.
Let's peel out.
All right. Well, until next week, keep two hands on the wheel.
Volleyball.